This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Hey, welcome to this week's show. We have a very old friend joining us tonight. There he is, ladies and gentlemen, direct from Florida. Let's hear it for Bruce Smirnoff. Bruce.
How did all these people get into my room?
It is so...
So you said to me, you said you just prepared a cocktail in order to speak to me. What are you drinking, Scott?
Well, I was trying to tell you before the interview that to get in the right spirit of talking to such a great comic and friend, that I had made myself a little cocktail, a little bourbon.
That, you know what you turned me on to? Again, you don't know the effect you had on all of us comedians. Many you put into a death coma, but I was one that escaped. But you taught me how to drink seriously. And to this day, I'm not a big drinker, but you know, I spent a lot of the last few years on ships, but you showed me a drink. It's whiskey with club soda. But the most important thing is you take the twist, the lemon twist, and you run it around the top of the glass, and you turn me onto that. And now because of that, I have Crown Royal. I know that's not yours. Were you Glenn Levitt? Yes, you were Glenn Levitt, right?
I enjoy a good glass of Glenn Levitt. Yes, I do.
Yeah, you turned me on to Glenn Levitt on the rock, club soda. In fact, while we talk, I'm going to have that. And I don't drink, but in honor, and I have lemon. I got lemon.
You're going all out for the podcast. I can't tell you how nice that is. And what I was trying to tell you in the pre-show, and you stopped me, was I can't believe it's been so many years, but it's just a pleasure to hook up with you and catch up and chat. You are always one of our favorite people, part of the family, and one of the top and funniest headliners to regularly played the club. So thank you for those years.
I had this is Chivas Regal. Is that whiskey?
Yeah, that's very good.
It smells like it. I have it in a decanter.
I put
scotch tape on the side, and it says ship it. So I know, this is probably 40. I don't know. This is I got this when probably not long after you turned me. I got to find I'm going to just do it like a normal person. Go ahead. Keep talking to me.
Well, I did want to introduce everybody to you by saying, and by asking, what brought you to working with me in Working Laughs Unlimited?
Well, as you know, I don't know if your listeners know, you were one of the first comedy clubs to get with the program. I remember working for you, I believe it was 1980, yes?
Yes.
Okay. So there was a comic boom that sort of started around 79, but that was in 78. And really, I think it was the Mork and Mindy in September of 78 that gave the gigantic gush, because Robin Williams was so popular at the Comedy Store. And it just turned the world into stand-up comedy freaks. Steve Martin, obviously, before that. But it was really that Mork and Mindy phenomenon. And then it was everything comedy. And then they had that silly show, Make Me Laugh. And that was on syndicated television, so everyone could see it. And no one really knew the difference between network TV and syndicated TV. It was just another channel on your television. So that became, out of nowhere, a very popular show. And that had all these guys that were unknown, but, you know, going to be famous eventually. And you were able to snag all those people.
Yeah,
and you're talking about big, big, big stars, ultimately, you know?
Big, big, big. Yeah, I was able
big, big,
to.
Big, 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 right.
I was able
Yakov,
to.
You had Yakov Smirnoff. You had Robert Wall. You had Kevin Nealon. I used to come up with Kevin all the time. So, yeah, you had Bruce Baby Man Bomb. Come on, help me with the names here.
We tapped into the early years of
Were comedy clubs. It was you. And because of that, and you were at the Delta Queen, you were in a restaurant and you were just the bartender there, right? And you were just, and then you got your own standalone club.
We took over the banquet room for a number of months. And then when they tried to force me out of business, I opened up
across
the street. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were
so that's when I'll tell you another story. When I had lived in L.A. I moved out there in 1970. I moved out in October of 78. So I moved there like 3 weeks after Mork and Mindy had premiered. So I got caught. I just moved to a town that was that phenomena, that Mork and Mindy, that Robin Williams fever. And I really wasn't good. And I wasn't accepted at the comedy clubs at that point. I had a really good look, but I just was so young. I was only 22. And I had done stand up in Boston where I was in college, but I really had not found my chops, nothing. And
but you started in Boston.
Here I was. I was in Boston. I went to Boston University Film School. And here I was in Hollywood and, you know, unable to get on stage, but not smart enough to realize to leave and go, you know, try to get good in another city. So I would, you know, I cobbled together to some of the worst clubs. Can you say swear words on your show, or you want it to keep it clean?
No, this dump.
I'll say dump. I was going to say shithole, but I'll just say dump. So you had to work the worst places. So anyway, you were so eager for acts that I don't know how I got to you, but you booked me as an MC opening act. And I guess I was good enough to, you know, to do 10 minutes of material. But the story that was amazing was I was never a great flyer, but from 78 to when I worked for you, I didn't fly at all. And I guess I was getting a little neurotic, and I developed, you know, your gig was in Sacramento, and I was going to be taking a plane that wasn't like a DC-10 or a 747. And I got so scared that I was going to take the bus from LA to Sacramento. And I had my friend drive me to the bus station in downtown LA. And you had to leave like at 2 a.m. to get to Sacramento by 5 o'clock the next day. And I got to the bus station, and there were so many horrible derelict people. I started to fear for my life. I said, I'll go on the plane. We'll go down. I don't care. I'm not going on a bus. What am I, out of my mind? And I never had my fear of flying. It was all stopped because of you. And I never, for the rest of my life. Which of course entailed incredible amounts of flying. Never another day.
Yeah, and we can say that you safely avoided the transit buses all those years, thanks to Laughs Unlimited.
That's right. These are things you have no idea, you know, but that I experienced, you know, on my way to your club, in your club. You know, I want to tell quickly. You housed us in that beautiful governor's, I think the governor lived in that condo.
Yes.
It was a tall, high story building in downtown Sacramento. And then you learned, unfortunately, not me, but there are other comedians that are slobberoos, have no respect for anyone, and they trashed your beautiful condo, you know? And then you took us on a series of these homes that you would buy in the most condemned areas of West Sacramento.
We were trying to find somewhere where the comics fit in. That was what it was.
Right. Yeah. I remember that house, and the neighbors had like a German shepherd dog, like a guard dog tied to a metal post in the yard to keep away the bad people. And it was right outside my window. And it was just, oh, so miserable. Anyway.
Well, we went out of our way to make everybody feel at home.
Yeah. One of the weeks that I worked for you, so let me explain to your listeners what it's like when you do a comedy condo or a comedy house. There's the master bedroom goes to the headliner. Then the small bedroom with the bathroom in the hallway, that's the middle act. And then if there's an opening act, that's on the road that week, they get the living room with the pullout sofa. So I show up and with Larry Miller, the great Larry Miller, who's as big of an actor as he is a stand-up comedian. He was the headliner.
Tremendous.
And I was the middle. And as we're getting assembled, you know, that we hear a thing at the door, and there's this elderly man. Now, when I say elder, he's probably like 67 years old, but I'm 63 now, so I can't call myself elderly. So to me, he was elderly. I was like 31 years old, maybe 20. I don't remember. So he comes in, and I'm like, who are you? And he goes, well, I'm whatever his first name was. I'm the MC this week. And he's dressed like in a business suit, but nothing fancy. And I'm like, what is this guy? He's the MC, and he's at this age. Who is he kidding? And he comes in, well, where do I stay? And I go, well, you know, Larry has the master bedroom. I have this bedroom. You get to pull out sofa. Wonderful. And he's like a happy camper. He's, you know, and he's setting up, taking out stuff out of his suitcase. Anyway, I don't really, he wasn't that good. But you could see he was really trying to do what he was doing. And I ignored him because I'm a prick and I'm, you know, I'm jealous of everyone. And I did, you know, if he couldn't help me, I guess he wasn't worth being stuck. Whatever. I was just, you know, like any comic was back then.
Well, sadly, over the years, I wish I could put a name to that person, but there was literally.
Well, let me finish the story. We'll sum that up at the end.
Oh, okay.
So this man comes and goes. That's the end of him. Fast forward. It turns out, I believe, I maybe have the company wrong. He was the owner and president of Mary Kay Cosmetics. And he was one of these people that did everything in the world. And one of the things he didn't accomplish in his lifetime was to be an idiotic stand-up comedian. So this was his bucket list. So this guy did, Craig Shoemaker would know his name because Craig hung out with this guy. It turned out that whoever he worked on the road with that was a golfer, he would then send for them in his private jet. And through the 90s and the 2000s, and I imagine he may not be with us anymore, but he was really kind to the people who were nice to him. Not me, but I didn't play golf. And,
how did you put and, it? But, you ignored
it
him.
It just goes to show you, be nice. Don't do what I do.
Yeah, be nice to everybody, right?
Be nice to everybody. The one guy I wasn't that nice to. I could have been vice president of America.
Well,
I'm in a 55 and over community in Delray Beach.
Instead of running Mary Kay. Well, that sounds like it had an important part of your life in the sense that a lesson learned, right? Can't judge it's a book one, by its cover.
Come on, with my horror stories, that's a fleck of dust.
A fleck of dust.
A fleck of dust.
Now, like I said,
I just want to be specific to Sacramento, even though I'm sure your listeners are nationwide, worldwide. I just want to get to feel Sacramento is the capital of California, and it is, other than cops, you were the only action that was in that city.
Oh yeah,
I love
definitely.
The episodes of cops from Sacramento because I can almost smell the neighborhoods, you know, because I went there so many times because of you. I must have been in Sacramento 20 plus times.
Oh, at least.
And you
worked the other clubs I own too. You didn't work just downtown. You did.
Well, I did Citrus Heights.
Birdcage, and then you Stockton.
And then that there was that guy. I'm blanking. I want to say it wasn't Esposito. Joe and God, he was so famous. And you broke them in, and they wound up bigger than you. That
That happened a lot. Yes.
Yeah,
and but that's okay.
I remember one night you were like, "Hey, Bruce, come over here." I go, "Yeah, this is Joe Torres. Joe and Christine Torres."
Right.
And you said, "This is Joe and Christine." And their partner was, maybe he was Esposito, but he was a nice guy. And I think they were like, they were building houses or, you know, they were like guys that were blue collar guys. I don't remember exactly, but you introduced them to me. And, you know, they're going to open up a comedy club and they came to watch you and, you know, see what it's all about. And I said, "Nice to meet you." And they wound up hiring me. It's so hard to get work as a comic, and it became that way because comedy got so hot. But there was a point because of you and the Torreses. I mean, and if there's any comedians listening to this podcast, it got to the point where I lived in LA. I really wanted to try my hand in acting and possibly get on TV and film. So I only needed, like, you know, 15 weeks a year, and it's so hard to get that. But in those days, because of you and those other people that you started, you would just pick up the phone and, you know, like, you would answer the hall. I go, "Scott, it's Bruce Smirnoff. Hey, Bruce, how you doing?" "Good, Scott." And then you just go, "Okay, I got my book open." And you would just give me, between your two clubs, I would get 2, 4, 6. I'd get like 8, 10 weeks a year. And I'd close my calendar and, you know, whatever, light a joint, whatever I did. And that was work.
You
right?
were good.
And then I would pick up the phone and I'd call San Jose. "Hi, Christina Torres." "Yes. Bruce Smirnoff." "Oh, hi, Bruce. How are you?" "I'm fine. How are you?" "I'm very good. Thank you. Do you have your book open?" "I have my book open." And they would give you, they had Portland, San Jose, Tucson, no, Phoenix.
They were very
and
successful.
And they had one more. Why am I blanking? Anyway, I think it was three, maybe it was four. And they, and then they would give you 4 weeks. And I'd close the book and I go, I don't need any more work for the year. That was, you know, I was living like a real bachelor. And that was, that's all you needed. You'd make your $20,000 or whatever. And you were a happy camper, and they paid airfare and room and board while you were there.
Right.
So, and yes, you were so wonderful. It was such a great time.
You bring up a good point, is especially when I had the three clubs, if you had somebody as popular and as part of our comedy family like you, and there was a few others, you could literally end up with 12 to 15 weeks in a year. And like you said, a lot of guys, that was enough to keep them busy. And it made us important, but it also gave us an opportunity to bring back people that we thought were really talented. It, you know, we're both using each other. You guys were getting some income and we were getting some great comedy that we could trust.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, and it was so over such a long window of time, which is also ironic because I work on the ship with someone from Sacramento, and I'm blanking on who exactly it is, but I think they knew who you were. But it was so fun. I watched when we first went to Sacramento, Old Town, which is where Scott's Club was located, was not doing well, correct?
No, it was. It started off as where the bums hung out.
Right. So when you did his club at first, it was like, well, I get it. There's a museum train thing, but there's nothing to do. And then within a few years, it became the rage.
Oh, yeah. We had a
and
lot
then
of nightclubs.
You opened up your spaghetti. Didn't you have an Art of Pasta?
The Art of Pasta, good memory.
And your photo gallery, you sold
cartoon gallery.
Cells.
Yeah. Wow, you have a good memory, Bruce.
I'm 63 years old. I'm not dead yet. I mean, you know,
Well, but a lot of people didn't pay attention.
I'm a fairly intelligent person, but yes, no, I'm just kidding.
No, but a lot of other comics wouldn't have paid attention. I did want to point
and then
out.
Was there an underground there where you could go under the street and you go, no, maybe not. But old time, I remember one time, God, this is terrible. And then it had a downturn. So I actually watched Sacramento down, up, then down. Mm-hmm. And now I think it's up again. Is it good again?
Yeah, it's doing okay.
Yeah.
What I was going to mention was that not only did you do great on stage and we had a lot of fun watching you entertain the crowds, but as I mentioned, you were part of the family and you did some of the activities off the stage with us. Didn't you go on us with us on bowling night or
that was great.
We used to do things with the entertainers outside of the club.
What was the name of that diner that we went to where you ordered above being overweight, you ordered like at 2 o'clock in the morning a stack of like 12 pancakes and like a tube of butter to put on it. And I turned to Alan Murray. I said, he'll be dead by Tuesday. We still do that line.
Oh,
couldn't believe anybody eating 12 pancakes at 2 o'clock in the morning. Couldn't believe that was when we were doing that Vegarama show. Remember?
Oh, Vegarama. In fact, Joe was mentioning today how you were part of Vegarama. We enjoyed doing that in the Firehouse Restaurant Theater. And
so to your listeners, that was an interactive show written by Rick Corso, another comedian. And it was like one of those Tony and Tina where the show is active. It's involving people in the audience and you don't know where it's going. And sometimes it's improv, but it's, you know, it's got a rough outline to it. So the thing was, you got to play we put you in the show and I played the owner of a Las Vegas casino and I'm a prick. And you were like a lowly assistant. So here's a comic who in real life, who, you know, respects the club owner and wants to work with him. But now the roles theatrically are reversed. So my character, all he does is belittle you and call you an idiot.
Yeah, I think you enjoyed that a little too much. One of my favorite lines from that show was one of the actresses was playing the part of the casino waitress, and Rick Corso is playing his headliner bit, and he says, "You know, hey babe, do me a favor and grab this person a cocktail," and she goes, "I'm an actress, not a waitress," and he goes, Yeah, well, then act like a waitress and get him a drink.
That was Chris. I'm blanking on her last name, but Chris is on Facebook. And Chris got married and had children, and she married a very successful man, and she's doing stuff in her own right. But yeah, remember, she used to date Richard Jenny. That was her boyfriend, yeah.
Well, that we had doing that show, which was real different than stand-up. I like breaking the rules of a comedy club and doing different things. And I mentioned in other episodes, I like bringing in variety entertainment like magicians and jugglers. And a lot of clubs didn't like doing that. But I also produced a few plays on stage with over the years. And after Vagarama.
After us or before us? Vagarama was 1994. Four, I believe. Three, four, somewhere in there.
Well, we did a
93.
Yeah, we did a couple one-man shows and a couple other mini plays that entertainers had written. But Vagarama was my favorite. In fact, Rick Corso and I looked very seriously at bringing that show back as its own piece, but we weren't able to do it. But it was something I really enjoyed doing.
Well, it got a lot of attention from HBO at the time, and I think the problem was they wanted to put a star in place of Rick, and you know he didn't want to. I don't think that was up his alley, but it did get a not a nibble, but a big nibble at HBO. I believe after that, Rick went on the road onto the cruise ships. He preceded all of us. He was one of the first to say that's where the money is. And
cruise ships are good. They're good money and a good way to make a living if you don't mind being on the sea all the time. Now you did a lot of.
It's a very hard thing. Very, very difficult.
You did a lot.
But that's where most entertainment now is focused, is working the cruise ships. There are so many of them.
Well, you've been in show business a long time, and you shared a couple stories about working with the club, but you probably have a story or two about being on the road. For example, Jill said one night after the show you were having a drink in the bar, and you told her you were hanging out with Bruce Jenner at a Hollywood party before he came out.
No, I was riding with my friend Billy Reback. We were a riding team, a few other members of it, and Billy was really the star of our group of writers. Billy's a brilliant writer. He went on to produce Home Improvement, blah, blah, blah. He's a very, very talented writer. And he would get hired to do these, you know, write jokes for somebody for giving a speech because he could just come up with jokes on the spot. So he comes to the session. He's late one day. He gets hired, you know, to write for Bruce Jenner, you know, the Olympic. Yeah, we know Bruce Jenner. Yeah. And he goes, yeah, so I was up in Malibu. And I mean, I was working with him writing jokes for his presentation, but I mean, he was like nail polish and, you know, he's like, he's got like makeup on and I'm like, yeah. Okay. So listen, today we're going to work. No, you don't believe me. Do you?
Well,
so,
a lot of people wouldn't Bruce believe Jenner. This famous decathlete was a cross dresser.
Right. And so Billy's going, no, he had makeup on. And he was like wearing like chiffon. It was men's clothing, but it was chiffon. And it was this. And I'm like, okay. So I just remember putting that in my head. And then we moved on for the day. And then that happened. You want the Bill Cosby story? I mean, I don't know if this is political. Who cares?
Who cares?
So he got hired to babysit Bill Cosby from a flight from Atlantic City to Washington, D.C., because his cousin was producing a show. His cousin was a big agent. And whatever it was, he said, Billy, I can't be with him. He needs around-the-clock attention. So can you just accompany him and, you know, maybe give him some jokes or go, whatever, just accompany him. So Billy accompanied him on a flight. And he said all he did was harass the stewardesses and make, you know, like lewd comments and you know, and then put them down when they walked away because they weren't reacting to him. He was having a miserable time with them.
Wow. Short order. Just well, this had to be, so Bill was a little older, but maybe not infamous.
It was 1984.
In 84, he acted like that?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
needed and to I be went, babysat?
I said, you're talking about America's dad? And he goes, oh, he's a bad guy. He hates everything. He hates white people, blah, blah, blah. He said he treated me like he was trying to antagonize me because he knew I was his aide, you know, the guy, the producer of the show, his cousin, and he was just trying to antagonize him, but I saw how he treated the stewardesses just terribly, sexually comments to them. Listen, whatever, that's a whole nother can of corn. We don't have to go into that. So yes, I have, you know, I was the doorman and host and MC at the Improv, the world famous Improv in Hollywood, Florida, California.
Down on Melrose, right?
On Melrose, from 1979 to like 83. And I always hung out there, but in those years I was like, you know, trying to get on performing, and I was the MC. I was like right under, you know, helping Bud Friedman, and then Bud took on a partner, Mark Lano, who then took the club from almost bankruptcy. I was there the night, or the afternoon, actually, when the liquor people came, and they like shoved a receipt in my face and go, "You don't pay this bill, you're never going to have liquor here again." And I did. I just went, okay. But I mean, I'm looking at the guy going, "It's not my club. Yeah. You can't talk to me that way. I don't have the money to pay you, and I'm not going to pay you. I don't care if you bring liquor here or not. I'm not the guy." But anyway, so Bud was really on the balls of his feet, because Bud had the idea, but not the execution. And he never did.
He
and
was always more of a showman, kind of a small man.
He was the idea and not the execution. So he then, out of last resort, he got this guy, Mark Lano, who was an actor and an acting coach, very talented in both ends, and a guy who had a business sense of how to run something. He got him to partner with him and to turn the club upside down. Like, when I worked there, everybody was stealing, you know, like it was just everyone was stealing, and we did no business. And Mark Lano turned it around. And at the same time that he turned it around, this show Evening at the Improv came about, and it looked like a very small adventure at the beginning, but it turned into a very long lasting series that really helped the Improv. And the thing with the Comedy Store, just, you know, a half a mile away, were owned by Mitzi Shore, was that when she was approached by people to do television, Mitzi was a real control freak. And because of her control issues, no one would want to make a deal with her. So she kind of scared people away. So as the Comedy Store was bigger, way bigger than the Improv, it did not attach itself to these other media.
She missed the opportunity.
Well, yeah, in a way. I don't want to put her down at all, because I loved her very much also.
She
missed that opportunity, and Bud picked up the opportunity, and Bud became, and Mark, extremely successful, and they turned their lives explosive, positive. So wonderful.
Yeah, and
I was there for everything.
When it came out.
I'll tell you a funny story. The book Wired. Now, here, I was just telling this story the other day. I was, all I wanted to be was a comedian. I wasn't a goody-goody. I mean, I smoked pot, so I wasn't this goody-two-shoes, but my goal was comedy, and I didn't understand other things and nuances in life. So I see this book, Wired, it's written about John Belushi, you know, and his life and him dying and of drug overdose and all this. But Belushi used to get his coke at the Improv, and it's talking about the Improv, and it's going, the Improv, the largest coke den in Los Angeles. And I'm going, wait a minute. I was there every night. What are you talking about? I didn't see any schmuck. It's funny. There's four tables in the restaurant. There's a restaurant area of the Improv circa 1981. Okay. And so obviously with a square restaurant, there's four corner tables. Well, one table is Bud Friedman and Mark Lano's table. So obviously that was their table every night. But the other three corner tables were these coke dealers that the book refers to. But I knew these guys, but I was very friendly to them, but they didn't do cocaine. So all I knew was, I once said to Guy X, because I'm not going to mention names here, but I said, "Guy X, I go, what do you do?" He goes, "I'm a movie producer." And I went, "Oh, that's wonderful." I never checked. I didn't care. I thought maybe he'll put me in a movie. So to me, he was X, was a movie producer. End of story. Then there was the other table. And this guy, his name, we'll call him Y. And I would say, "Y, what do you do?" And he goes, "I'm a male nurse." And I went, "Oh my goodness, The world needs nurses, and we need male nurses. You're doing something. What do you come here at night for? I just like that. I'm around a lot of pain with the patients all day, and I like to have a
they all had a story.
Went, that's beautiful. These are the biggest coke dealers in history, and I'm listening to their nonsense, right? Then there's another table, and this guy, great guy, he owned a store that dealt with vintage watches. And I just figured that's what, because I used to bring my vintage watches that I would get on the road at pawn shops, and he would fix them. So I thought he was a watch guy. Everybody was the front. And the stories you read, I'm going, this was all going on. What a moron I was.
Well, if you're not part of the party, I guess they didn't want to make you aware, but that's interesting. I was there many, many, many times and sat at some of those tables, but was not part of the drug scene either. That was something we always tried to avoid at the club. Although
yeah,
there
you're
was...
a square. You're not one of those people.
No. Yeah, but it was funny. No. One night, John Fox had a spoon of coke and was chasing me around the green room. Come on, it won't kill you. Come on, give it a shot.
Now, this podcast, do you want terrible stories, or you just want to keep it on the up and up?
Oh, no, we're just trying to be entertaining. I did want okay. to. You've had a lot of great.
You did mention I was with him near the end, and he was an enigma in that he, John Fox is who we're talking about, and it had a very sad ending to his life.
Yeah.
I will tell you, men, please have your, you know, your prostate checked, get your blood checked. I think he left a nice message urging people to do that. But he was the example of why we couldn't stay at nice condos. He was a gonzo comedian in that he was just this ribald guy that was bawdy, filthy, triple X rated, but he had a look of him like an all-American boy.
Surfer
and he's
dude.
Just like, let's party. And you can Google him or YouTube him. But he had a magnetic thing over a hypnotic spell over the audience. So even though his material was filthy, not creative, and I'm not putting him down, but there was nothing there but a barroom, you know, drunkish guy telling these jokes, but standing ovations, 52 weeks a year of work. But he lived his life. You put me in that condo with him one day, and I come up one night. And he's like having sex with like three women. I'm going, I'm trying to watch a baseball game. Can you take it in another room?
And he's yelling, batter up.
I couldn't believe. I mean, again, I'm not approved, but I don't, you know, this stuff was like, I can't believe. I grew up in the suburbs, you know, Connecticut. I never saw behavior like this, people having open sex in a comedy condo. But he's another lunatic, probably with the throwing the furniture off the balcony that led to the demise of Scott Edwards.
Yeah, John,
up in that nice building.
Yeah, if you go to the dictionary.
Do you drink coffee? Do you drink coffee?
No.
Okay. When we stayed downtown, then you took us to another place that wasn't as nice, but still nice, when we left that tower building. And I found this coffee. This is when I first got into specialty coffee. And I'll never forget the name. It was called New Helvetia. And
right.
I think that is what, that's a dog. I think I think a Helvetian is a Dalmatian, something like that. And they were located, I don't know where, but, you know, right in the heart of where, you know, where people come out of Senate and then their restaurants were. And that was the coolest. We're talking like 1982. This
oh, yeah,
is
that
like
was a
years
very hot place.
Before Starbucks did anything, you know. And
oh, yeah.
That was, it was built around the roaster in the middle of it and the muffins and the coffee. And they were great. And, you know, I Google them sometimes, even the name, nothing. It was all pre-internet. So nothing ever, I just wish those people, hope they had good, successful lives because they had such a great place down there.
Well, Bruce, I want to get back to your comedy. You have some
Why?
Great, because it's funny. You've got great
bits.
Let me
tell you a funny story.
Where did you get your comedy from?
Well, as a kid, I listened to Bill Cosby records and Bill Cosby had like no effect on me. And yet that's what I think hooked me, where his albums were so amazing. And I grew up very isolated in suburbs, but more country than suburbs. And I couldn't express myself. So these records, these comedy records did it for me. So I would say Bill Cosby. And then comedy in general, watching the Ed Sullivan Show, all that stuff. And then I guess Robert Klein, which is a lot of the New York guys.
Yeah, I could see you being like Robert Klein.
He was the password. You know, he was like the gateway to so many of our generation. When you break down comedy, there's comics that are bad writers but fantastic performers, and then vice versa. And then there's guys that have everything. And he was in baseball, they call that a five-tool player. So he was a five-tool player in comedy. He could write, he could act, he could do voices, he could sing. He just could do everything. And he made it look so easy that all these knuckleheads like myself and all these guys that were influenced by him, just, even I think Leno was totally influenced by him too. And Leno wasn't a Jewish kid from the city or the suburbs. He was from Massachusetts, but he was a influence on a whole first generation. And what's interesting is Robert Klein, as great as he is, he did not achieve this fame he deserved because it was just so New York and so cool and so hip.
And he was early before the real boom of stand-up. He was more the hungry tiger.
He created the boom.
Yeah.
He created the boom of stand-up. He was the reason people would go to the Improv when it was, I forget how Bud opened it. It was like a place to go after Broadway, but I don't even think it had booze yet. I think it was like coffee and tea and desserts. You'd have to read his book. I don't remember exactly, but having Robert Klein there was like the first guy, like, we got to go see this guy, Robert Klein. And that, so he was like one of the first. So yeah, brilliant, phenomenal. So that's how I got influenced by his album.
Well, your comedy, it was always hilarious, and you had a great mixture.
Not that great.
No, you did. You had a good mixture. I liked about your act, or I think the audience liked about your act, was that you had smart material, but you had an expressive personality. For some reason, what's coming to mind, like you see, if you saw an Italian doing a speech and they're using their hands and using their facial expressions, you could control your face, your arms, but your facial expressions were always memorable and fit perfectly with the material. Right. Now, sadly, we can't share that physical part, but right now we're going to take a quick break and listen to a set from you, Bruce, if that's okay.
Oh, the torture.
Yeah.
The torture time.
Everybody sit back and relax. Some great stand-up comedy. Here he is, Bruce Smirnoff, live on stage.
She got my juices going. It's a good thing I dress very sexy tonight. That's another thing. I'm in this business a long time, and I know you have to feel good thoughts and feel sexy, but when I 42 years I'm in show business. When I started out, I wanted to be a Chippendales dancer. And I went on my first audition, took off my clothes. They said I should be a comedian. You're smiling. You know, sexy is making people laugh, of course. You know, when I was in fifth grade, all the girls used to drool over me. It was a special school, but they liked me. Fifth time. These are the jokes, but these are what are called self-deprecating jokes. I don't make fun of you. I take it all out on myself. It's a lot safer for my health to do it that way. And you would think people would appreciate it. I'm on a ship, again, maybe 6-7 months ago. I'm up in the buffet, and this woman's like waving me over. Like, oh, no. Yes, ma'am. How are you? Because I watched your show the other night. You make a lot of fun of yourself. I don't appreciate your humor. I happen to think you're a very handsome man. And I said, thank you very much. And then she turned around and walked into a wall. Roughest, you ever been to a biker bar? Probably not. This place, like a 2-tattoo minimum just to walk in. The ladies' room had urinals in it. Just a rough joint. So at the end of the show, the bikers want to go have a beer with you. Like, I can have like one beer in it, but they get a little wasted, and they've never met ethnic people like me from the East Coast. So it always starts that they get real chum. I want to ask you a question. I go, yeah, sure. What do you need to know? They go, how come you Jews? I like it when they started out, you Jews. I'm looking around. Maybe a bus showed up. Who's here? What? Where's Uncle Morty? Did I get a toy? Who came? Company's here. I go, how come you always lawyers and doctors and in show business? You different than us? I go, hey, man, read your basic U.S. history. Like all the great ethnic people that came to the United States, we assimilated, got with the program. End of story. However, if you want one, and I mean one teeny tiny difference, we don't seek dangerous jobs like everybody else. Because let's face it, when they find a telephone worker slumped over an electrical pole with 10,000 volts shooting through his body, do you think that's Murray Schekelstein? You are such a nice group. I'm only up here for like 3 days. These are very short gigs up here. We love this so much. Back to my life in Delray, and then there'll be more blind dates. That's what my life has come down to. The people in my community fix me up. Now, I'm looking for somebody my own age. I like 60, maybe 59, 61. But they fixed me up. My last blind date was like, I think it was in April. She was 40 years old, lived in Boca. I went to pick her up at her condo. She opens up the front door. I look inside. There's a 3-foot iguana running around. I said, what the hell is that? She goes, it's my baby. I was afraid to ask who the father was. And we get in the car. We're not together 2 minutes. She starts making announcements. Bruce, in 1 year, I want to be married and have a baby. I looked at her. I said, you don't get many second dates, do you? I said, kidnappers give the hostage's family more time to go over the ransom note. She goes, I'm sorry, it's my biological clock. So I tapped her on the forehead. I said, I just hit the snooze alarm. I took her to the Cheesecake Factory. It's like my favorite place. We get in. Waitress hadn't even arrived yet with the menus. My date leans across the table. She goes, hey, Bruce, you think I should get a boob job? I didn't know what to say. I said, why don't you have one done, see if you like it? I was being tortured. I was ready to confess to the Lindbergh kidnapping, okay? Do you ever feel that God has put a curse on your life for something you did a long time ago? You got to pay for it every day. It's true. I think it all started when I tore up a chain letter in 1971. Never should have done that. Then my date starts telling me about the ex-husband. I don't want to hear about the ex-husband. Just my ex-husband was a crack addict. I said, if I was married to you, crack would just be an appetizer. Then the food comes halfway through the meal. Another announcement. Bruce, where do you see this relationship developing into? I said, a murder-suicide. I'm driving her home as fast as I can. She another announcement. Bruce, you know something. I'm not like the other women. I don't go all the way on the first date. I said, I didn't think you did. And I dropped her off at the bus stop. You're so lucky. You're so lucky you found one another. You know, my family came to the United States. I don't know what our histories are said, but they came from Russia. 1906, they fled. And to this day, when I meet these new Russians that come to America, oh, these are the hottest women. I got it. So I go play around on the internet. I found this one website, RussianWomen.com. And I found this one woman, she's living in Chechnya. This is what her profile said. Conditions in my country are so horrible, I will do absolutely anything to get out. Now that's what I want to hear. So I emailed her my photo. She writes back, I think I'm going to tough it out here for a while. Thank you very much. You guys are, you're on fire. You're the best. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, that was Bruce Smirnoff live on stage. Thanks for sharing that with us, Bruce.
Is anyone still listening?
Yes, they're still out there.
They're throwing their computers out the window.
Hey, you and I sadly have not seen that much of each over the last 20 years. Why don't you catch us up? What have you been up to?
Well, I moved. I left L.A. I had written a one-man show, and I tried to, you know, it was actually very well received, and if I may say so, it was a great show. And it got me almost to what I wanted, which was always, you know, to be on a sitcom. And this would have gotten me kind of like my own show, but it didn't happen. So I got for the first time, I was in LA for 23 years, you know, and for the first time I started to see the cracks in the veneer. Like, I don't know if I can keep taking this. So I stayed another 2 years and I took the one man show. I knew it wouldn't go on. It wouldn't become a sitcom, but I turned it into a mockumentary, you know, like a fake documentary. Right. And I had the script. I composed it with my director, Dan Cohen, and we had it. I went to digital film school. This is the beginning of the digital video where it would look like film, you know, which is what we see everything on TV now. This is the beginning of it. So I could have made this film for less than like about $30,000. And I had that money allocated and I was going to make this mockumentary. And then a Larry David's fantastic show came out and I really felt that, first of all, Larry David was a god to television, you know, and with Jerry, him and Jerry, I don't have to explain it. And when his show hit, it was given a 10-year contract. And my show wasn't the same show, but it was in that vein. And I knew that it was just, you know, there was no way, if I spent this $30,000, I honestly believe it would have been pissing, you know, down the drain.
So you never did the production.
So I came to what's that town? There's a come to Jesus, but they also call it a come to Damascus moment where I said, you know, I've got to stop this nonsense of trying to become famous. It's not about being famous. It's about being a comedian.
Well, it's about making a living doing what you love.
Yes. So I had to test myself. So I moved to New York in 2001 to just be a comedian and not care about going out for commercials and not trying to be me, famous. It was to test myself to do stuff. So I moved to New York and I moved to Brooklyn. It was really good. I got it because I was really good at, I was a bad comic in the late 70s and mostly through the 80s. I finally got good around maybe, let's say, 90, 91, 92. Then I got really good. I'm really good, but it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. But so I went to New York. I was really good. And so I got on at all the good clubs. And I was like this older guy, even though I was only 46.
Yeah, that's old for comedy, yeah.
That's old for comedy. So these young guys loved me, and they gather in a room, and they all started to talk like me. It was very funny. And my audience, like at the comic strip in New York on a Friday and Saturday night, you're talking about like 18-year-old Puerto Rican kids from the Bronx and Brooklyn kids and all this stuff. And I'm killing because I'm like their father. It's almost like how Rodney, you know, when Rodney was like a generation or two older when
he became a hit in his 50s, mid to late 50s.
Right. Exactly. Yes. And correct. And so did my friend Jackie Mason. He had two different phases of his career. Anyway, so it was great, but then something happened, and I'll tell you what happened. It was the show Last Comic Standing, and Jay Moore was a friend of mine who really loved my one man show. He was a big fan of mine. He sought me out, and we had the last couple of years in LA was very friendly with him. He was a great, talented guy, and I knew he was hosting the show, and I was appalled that no one called me, you know, to even do an audition. And then what happened? And I said, why aren't they calling me? Why? I'd be great on Last Comic Standing. Why aren't they calling me? And then I came to another come to Damascus or whatever Jesus moment where I said, I caught myself. You're trying to be famous. You can't do that. It either comes to you or you forget about it. You can't chase this tiger. It's whatever the expression is. You can't chase this. It's not, you know. So I got really pissed off at myself, Scott. And I said, I got to move away from New York. I got to further distance
myself. So you blamed yourself.
I blamed myself.
Well, that's too bad.
It was my fault. So I moved to Florida to like try to get out of show business. I said,
big stand-up hub, by the way, Florida.
It's non-existent. It's like trying to find a swimming pool in the desert, right? So I moved to Florida, and I'm trying to... I have no business sense. All I know is trying to be a comedian from 18 years old. I don't know anything else. So I'm trying to, with my savings, I'm trying to find someone, you know, maybe I can open up a coin-operated laundry because, you know, you know, I need a start. or maybe a yogurt, and no one would take me. I had the capital, and no one would take me on as a partner. So what happened was, unknowingly, I wandered into, yes, there's no comedy clubs per se in Florida,
right,
but there's plenty of places to perform, which I didn't understand. There's all these senior citizen places. So with a little bit of, I had become this young babe, even though I was 46 years old, I was now a youngster compared to these 80-year-old people. And the performers who performed for these 80-year-old people had also become 80 years old. And there was no one in between that gap. So here was this new guy that could work these ethnic, mainly Jewish or some Italian, but mostly New York audiences that moved to Florida. And with a little bit of trying, I became like a really big act down here. And I did very well.
I bet they loved your material. And you were never dirty.
I had to change a lot of my material.
Did you really?
You can't be caustic. Oh, yeah. Remember I used to do the joke about my grandmother had Alzheimer's disease and Lou Gehrig's disease. She swears she hit 100 home runs, but she never remembered when, right?
That was
I go, I shouldn't do that joke because grandma's no longer with us. We traded her to Cleveland. Well, that used to be one of my big, she's batting 307. That was like a big joke of mine. And when I did that the first time at these condos, I lost the audience because these people, their husbands or wives are suffering from that disease. And you're not wearing, you have to look at this world with their eyes, not with a youngster who's got a screw it all attitude. So I really had to X out almost 15 minutes of my material and come up with different stuff. That's why the transition took me about a year. But then within a year or two, I was like a top.
I was going to say, with your talent, I'm sure you came up with plenty of material about the
move. But I'm really, really, really good now, but I'm cornball. So,
living in Florida joke?
I got a million of them. But I don't put me on the spot. When you put me on the spot, I can't come up with one. Up with one. But I'm getting somewhere. Not only am I good, now there's these cruise ships down here. And I never thought I would do well on a ship because, like I said, I become like a fuddy-duddy with my material. And these cruise lines, they got kids and families, and some of them are very ultra-religious people, that are very Bible, and I don't want to upset the apple cart. But I did not know about these luxury cruise lines that have elderly people that are gazillionaires and five-star service, and I didn't know about that. And then one of these lines heard about me, and I had to fill in for a comic, and I was very nervous, and they said, look, just do what you can do, because it was last minute. It was actually Sammy Shore who hurt his back and couldn't make the cruise. So they said, can you be at the port in like 3 hours? I say, I live like 10 minutes from it. Sure. So I went on the ship. So this way was the best way to get on. There was no pressure. If I didn't do well, no problem. If I did well, even better. And I did great.
Too. Yeah, good.
And that started me on about a 12-year run on these ships, doing as much as half the year on these ships. You lose your mind, but you make a lot of money, and it is extremely lonely. Even though you're around people, it's a very weird, weird, weird experience. And,
yeah, because you're not on vacation. You're part of the crew. And so,
no, I'm not part. No, 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 no.
Well,
I'm
mean,
not part of the crew.
But listen, you're also not on vacation.
No, no. I'm not on vacation. I'm working, correct. But no, the beauty about this gig is I'm a passenger. I've got as great of a cabin as these millionaires from Iowa. The guy who owns the corporation, I'm in the same room as him with the walk-in bathroom, marble bathroom, walk-in closet, balcony.
Cruise quarters.
They do. I didn't. When you work on these exclusive lines, this is what it's different. So I fell into a bucket of poop. I got lucky. Okay. But let me tell you the first step of getting lucky. So I did that first cruise, and then they gave me this big contract, like 13 weeks. And I go on my first official cruise after my trial run, and it's in Alaska. And half or three quarters of the cruise is chartered by funeral directors.
Okay. Oh,
geez. And I got to tell you something about funeral directors. They're not a fun bunch of people. They're obviously, this is not a big thing. So, okay, that being said, I go on stage and my audience is basically all funeral directors. I'm ready to go. Not a problem for me. And as they're introducing me, a terrible thing happens. Someone has like a heart attack. And this is going on about 90 seconds before I'm being introduced. And the MC of the show is introducing me from backstage. So he's not aware of this incident. That there's people
somebody literally dying on the floor,
pounding on his chest.
Oh,
and like,
geez.
And so they introduce me. And as I walk out on stage, my microphone is cut by the master PA system, which is the captain of the ship going code blue, showroom, code blue, which means a medical emergency in the showroom. And oh my God, it's like my first time, you know, it's my second week on a cruise, my first week of this contract, and I've got to prove myself. And here is this master catastrophe. Now, working for you all these years and working for other comedy clubs, you got young people. There's no problem going on. But when you're with 80-year-old people, this is what happens. And it's happening at the worst time. And they're pounding, and I'm standing there like a schmuck, and it's never happened to me. Now it's happened to me a few times. I know how to deal with it, but I didn't know how to deal with it at the
time. That would be scary.
And like a moron, I look at the audience, and I, as I'm watching this, I go, looks like someone's going to get a little extra work this week.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did, because I was stuck between a rock and a hard place, and I had to do something. I didn't. This never happened to me before. So I said that. And the, oh my God, very inappropriate, to say the least. And I couldn't stop myself. And then I said, look at the bright side, folks. You can write this trip off as a taxable deduction. And oh my God, one by one, they got up and left the room. But not like at once, one by one, like a row of corn, six up, out. And I'm doing my act. About 20 minutes in, I went from like 400 people to like 40 people. And they didn't leave. Finally, the 40 people, they were in for the long haul. Oh, that was terrible. And they fired me. And so all those weeks, I lost those weeks. But then I got back to Miami and I called my agent and I said, this is what happened. And I just basically told her what I just told you. And she's screaming at the end of the phone. She's on the floor laughing. She goes, this is just, what are you going to? So they called the cruise ship line. This is unprecedented. And they put me on with the vice president of the ship line. And I said, I'm very sorry that this happened, but here's what happened. And I've never had experience with this in my life. And I told him the story. And he starts laughing on the phone. So he goes, no problem. We're putting it back on. You're on with the Manhattan trip. So he said, I'm going to be on the ship. So I'm going to watch you and make sure everything is kosher. So I was on with the Manhattan Transfer. You know who they are.
Oh,
they're,
yeah,
phenomenal.
Big group.
And one of my great, they were really big at the same time Robert Klein was big. So it was like the Manhattan Transfer and Robert Klein were like, oh, they were like my heroes. And here I got to work with them. So I'm in the middle of my act, probably like 5 minutes in, and the vice president, you know, this is when he renewed, you know, let me come back on. And he's like in the second row. And I did a big, you know, they're screaming. And I remember this one particular joke. It's just explosion of laughter. And I just look over at him and he gives me the, you know, the high sign. And that was it. So, you know,
next 12 years were taken care of.
Yeah. Yeah. All taken care of.
Oh, wow. So that would be shocking that somebody's out there dying when you could get introduced.
So, yes, you're right. So, since then, it's happened three more times, not on ships per se, but on land gigs, right? Going on, woman falls down, head bleeding, but the whole, but now I know what to do. And let me, and if there's any entertainers out there, this is what you do. You have to put on your big boy pants. You go above entertainer. You actually become like police officer, ambulance / worker and advisor. And you just go out and go, ladies and gentlemen, there will be a delay in the show. And you say it, you're not saying it in a comedic way. You're saying it as someone that's taking, people want control to be taken when there's chaos. And you have to, I mean, this is the shit you learn doing this stuff. So you have to, so this woman fell before I went on at this big Jewish organization. Ugh, with their blood all over. She didn't die or anything, but blood, and they're mopping. And I just want to, ladies and gentlemen, there will be a delay in this evening show. And they got it all taken care of. They took her out right in front of everybody in an amp, you know, on a gurney and the whole thing. And, you know, I went on And the show was like, they knew what happened. I knew what happened. So we kind of, they laughed politely at my jokes and I did them. I did my act, you know, as good as I could after seeing such a terrible thing happen. So all in all, it was like a, you know, an okay experience. I didn't bomb and the audience wouldn't let me bomb because they understood what had just happened.
But those are the kinds of, yeah, those are the kinds of things that happen on the road that you just can't plan for. And you have,
no. Well, now I can.
Well, now
I can handle almost anything. Like when you're on a ship, they have these codes. Like if it's code blue means there's a medical emergency. And if God forbid there's a fire, that's code Bravo.
What's the code for iceberg?
Listen, you wanted a joke. I was in the middle of a joke. You're interrupting me. Just like you always did. You got to interrupt. Because then I was going to say, and if somebody jumps off the ship, it's code refund. And that's a great joke. And you had to step on it. But you always step on it.
Oh, Bruce, I'm sorry.
You're the best.
No, I just... Crazy. So it sounds like you did some moving around, but you settled in somewhere where you're comfortable.
Do you know that I was with Jeff Burkhart? You remember him, right?
Yeah.
You got to get him on this podcast because he has become maybe one of the top comedians. He's on the ship so much now that I don't think he gets a week off. And he's saving his money. But he was just starting out, and he was working with me at your club, and you're bending over backstage. You were fixing something and you're like giving me an order. Go make sure tonight, whatever you say. And Jeff and I are walking by you and like the crack of your ass is like exposed while you're like trying to fix a wire. And I just looked at you and I said, blow it out your ass. And Jeff Burkhart to this day goes, you said that to a club owner. I said, that's Scott Edwards. It's not a club owner. It's Scott Edwards.
Well,
and to this day, whenever he calls me, I go, hello. I'll just hear, why don't you blow it out of your ass?
Well, thank you for sharing that moment.
Yeah. But,
well, you're a very funny guy, and I think that you have lots of opportunity, and your experiences on stage have made you one of the best reactive and entertaining comics that we've had. And like I said,
I won't agree with you. I'm really good, but I won't, but not some of the greatest you have.
We love Uncle Brucey.
You were trying to wrap up the show, I think, right? So I mean, I'm stepping over you. I apologize.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I step on your jokes. You step on my podcast. It's fair. Hey, I did want to say thank you for doing this. We enjoyed your comedy set. I've enjoyed catching up and hearing what's been going on and some of the stories from the past. Bruce, always a pleasure. We're going to not let another 20 years go by. Let's stay in contact. And
thank you, Scott. Thank you, listeners. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
Everybody in the audience, and if you ever make it out to Florida, you look up Bruce Smirnoff. If you're on the cruise ship, check out who
the entertainer
is.
They can find me on YouTube, Scott. Just have them Google me on YouTube. Have them look me up.
Well, there you go. We appreciate you listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. There's going to be a new show coming out next Sunday. And Bruce, what can I say? It's been a long...
It's a pleasure, Scott.
Oh, long, pleasurable journey with you, and it's not over yet.
No, it isn't.
All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You have a good week. Bruce, you take care. Thanks for listening. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.